Dr. Mojgan Semihi, PhD, has worked with socially and environmentally sustainable development through planning, public policy, and academia in partnership with both non-governmental and intergovernmental organizations for over 20 years. Dr. Semihi has a doctorate in urban planning, policy, and design from UC Irvine, with a specialization in healthy and sustainable planning process and public policy. She's been selected as one of the 25 Empowering Sustainability Fellows at UC Irvine, in addition to conducting collaborative research with global institutions on informal settlements and global health. She's also a major specialist at the UCI Sustainability Initiative and a lecturer in public health. Let us put our hands together and welcome Dr. Mojgan Semihi.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Nice smiles. So I could actually not talk anymore because the great quotations and the music kind of summed it up. So thank you. Just joking. May I please say hello to my mom, who's joining us on webinar from the state of Washington. Hi, Mom. And thanks to all the family and friends that are either here or joining via webinar in Washington, which my mom forced them to do. I'm so sorry. Thank you for joining us. As you know, oh, by the way, I'm so delighted to be here, and all of your wonderful smiling faces looking at me in anticipation of me teaching you something. That's not going to happen, maybe. I'm not sure. One of the most beautiful things about getting all these degrees is that you realize you know nothing. So after I got these wonderful degrees from all of these great institutions, I realized there's much more I don't know, and I just should be in school for the rest of my life. The good news is, life is school. So you can always adopt a humble posture of learning throughout your life and feel like a student wherever you are. So please don't take this talk as me being an expert. I don't believe I'm an expert. I never have. I believe that, as Jamshid so nicely put it, we're all collaborators in this collective learning project. So I'm here to challenge more your borders in your mind than the national borders that we have in the world. Okay, so these borders in the mind, to me, are more detrimental to the future peace and security of our world than the national borders that we see. So I want you to go with this spirit as you're listening to the few humble words from my experiences and from my research that I present. When the title of this talk was originally given to me, Global Citizenship, I took the liberty of changing it. It's okay, I have a PhD, I can do that now. And the topic became social transformation, people power, and the planet. I realized that for me, global citizenship, this concept of global citizenship, was about transformation, was about getting rid of the borders we have in our minds that limit our thinking narrow, put us in these narrow spaces and silos. So that's kind of where I'm heading for the social transformation and these three concepts, people, power, and the planet. Is that okay? I completed my doctorate last year, as Jamshid mentioned, in an interdisciplinary study between urban planning, public policy, and health. At the essence of my dissertation, it's about rapid urbanization of our planet, rapid uncontrolled urbanization of our planet. In the year 2006, the United Nations reported that 51% of our global population lives in an urbanized setting. By the year 2025, it is predicted that 75% of the world will live in an urbanized context, not just from demographic changes within a city, but because of the rapid industrialization and urbanization of our planet. So I started to realize, when I was working in the international sector, how is this going to impact our world, our health, our relationships with one another? Cities are very much energy consuming and greenhouse gas emitting. How is this going to affect our planet? How are countries and cities going to, how are countries going to compete with cities? New York City has a higher GDP than most countries in the world. How are we going to compete with this? What is this urbanization going to impact? What are the consequences and what are the opportunities? Because cities are also places of extremely wonderful diversity and life. When I started thinking about this, I started thinking also that cities are the model of development. So if we challenge this concept of what is a city, we're actually dealing with understanding what is development. Why does everyone want to look like New York? I was recently in India where I had the wonderful opportunity of working with the Baha'i Office of Public Affairs on increasing discourses of governance in policy circles. That was one of my tasks. I was there just to provide service. One of our conversations centered on youth and governance. One of the youth asked the policymakers in India a very astute question. He said, "Why are we running towards being China? We're India. Why do we need to be China?" Policymakers couldn't answer that question for him. 19-year-old high school student, almost college student. Why do we need to be China? The same debates that existed about 60 or 70 years ago when people were asking, why do we need to be New York? So these conversations are happening, and to me, these are part of the global forces that are changing our systems, changing the way that we make a boundary on the concept of, for example, development. So I studied urban planning to understand why we're perpetuating a particular vision of development. I came across a planning scholar who I recommend to everyone if you're interested in these topics. Her name is Dr. Libby Porter. She's an Australian planner who analyzes planning as a culture. Is that interesting? So usually when we think of culture, what do we think of? What do we think of when I say culture? Country origin. What else? Sorry? Tradition, music, dance. We don't think about professions, do we? How many engineers here? Raise your hands. How many Persians here? Yeah, same people? No, almost one. Sorry. Cultural humor. Engineering is also a culture. The most interesting thing for me about understanding Libby Porter's perspective, is that culture is not, we're not born knowing culture. Are you born knowing how to speak Persian? No, but we're born with capacities. All of us have the capacity to learn and communicate. That's what we need to focus on, not tradition. What is tradition? It's a habit of thought. It's a learned behavior. It's a learned practice. So guess what? We can unlearn it. Whoa. In fact, Dr. Porter's book is called Unlearning the Colonial Culture of Planning. Whoa. She argues in her book that planning culture is predominantly a colonial construct and that the practice has not changed for over 100 years. Zoning is a colonial construct. Let's divide the native people of this country from the colonial people because, oh my God, we're going to get sick. Little did the colonial powers know that it was them making the natives sick. And they called them natives. That's not my words. Indigenous communities. In India, the Adivasi, the indigenous communities, Adivasi means we were here first. In those communities, the colonial powers had to maintain control. They had to have this power. Oh, we want to maintain control, power over. And we're still perpetuating the colonial construct of planning, colonial culture of planning, without critical reflection on what we're actually doing. Interesting. So her study focused on Aborigine communities in Australia. And at first, she was trying to understand how Aboriginal communities were gaining access to the planning, the legal industrial complex of planning in Australia so that they can increase their control over their own lands, over their own native tribal historic lands. She said, then I got into the communities and embedded myself as a very traditional planner, was not cognizant of the fact that I had a particular culture or this construct. And I realized, oh my gosh, the Aboriginal communities have a fundamentally different perspective and relationship with the land than the colonial power. In the colonial mindset, in the culture of planning, the dominant culture of planning, fascinating for me to see this in Dr. Porter's work, land-people relationships have conflict, and it's embedded. It's all about controlling the land, gaining access to it, gaining ownership of it, and then being able to extract it and create a system of economic growth. Mine, not yours. No, this is mine. So there's so much competition embedded in it. Whereas she was saying the Aboriginal communities didn't even have this construct. They believe they are put on this planet to be stewards of the land. They do not believe you can own the land. In fact, land ownership is a form of slavery to most indigenous communities around the world because they have a very different understanding of the planet. It is not just a rock floating through space, providing us with food, energy, and resources. To the indigenous communities around the world, the planet is Mother Earth. It needs to be protected. It needs to be healed when it is in crisis. So their relationship with the land is so fundamentally different that Dr. Porter was saying, forget capacity building in the Aborigine communities. We need to do capacity building in the planning community. We need to have this construct of planning, different relationship, land and people. We need to build the capacity of planners to understand this, to unlearn. And what's interesting about planning, it's a global culture. I can go into any country in the world and I will know the practice of planning. Doesn't matter what government context it is. It doesn't matter if it's a centralized or decentralized country. The process of planning is very similar. Now imagine if rather than having this dominant culture of land use planning being conflictual, competitive, commoditized, monetized, we took the perspective of the culture of the indigenous communities around the world where we believed that it's collective stewardship of the land, that we are not separate from this land. How different would planning practice look if we unlearned this colonial practice and instead implemented this different relationship? Dr. Porter taught me that planning not only has a dominant culture that needs to be challenged, but that we need to teach planning students this alternative way to have relationship with the land. And we also need to teach engineers that alternative. And I'll get to that in a minute, all the Persian engineers in there. Culture itself gives academics job security because it's so complex and you can approach it from so many different ways that if you decide to be a scholar studying culture, you'll have tenure and study for the rest of your life and get a lot of funding. I know this from personal practice. Now, if we think about culture as learned practice, tradition, habits of thought, then we take some of the traditional planning theorists like Jonathan Friedman, who said planning is just applying knowledge to the public domain. Then the question becomes, whose knowledge? My knowledge, dominant planning culture, or indigenous knowledge? Or both? Why can't we have both? I started out my research actually focusing on slums around the world. I wanted to understand the diversity of perspectives on slums because I knew that part of the urban planning culture is to clear slums. And I wanted to understand where this comes from. So I began in Nairobi, in Kenya. How many people have been to Nairobi? Have you been to Kibera? Kibra? You've been to Kibra? Describe Kibra to me a little bit.
Kibera is the largest slum in Africa. It's 700,000 live. Basically, the construction looks like traditional mud mud and stick houses, actually.
When were you there last?
I was there 8 years ago.
Okay, so I was there most recently about 4 years ago, and it's changed dramatically. 1 million people, estimated, live in the urban slum in Nairobi, in Kenya. Within a one square mile area, 1 million people. There is a diversity in the slum that people don't realize. It is not just brick and, I mean, it is not just mud houses. There's brick, there's formal settlements, there's informal settlements, there's cardboard boxes. There's a diversity of people that live in the slum. It's not just people that don't have anywhere to go. Civil servants live in the slum. Because there's no affordable housing in Nairobi, so they live in the slum. They pay slumlords more money, relatively speaking, in rent than New York City citizens do. It's ridiculous. It's historic. It's been around for about 100 years before the creation of the country of Kenya. Most people don't realize this when they go to the slum. It's existed for 100 years. The planning world and the government and international organizations look at the slum as a problem to be solved. The residents look at the slum as the solution to a problem. So my question is always, when I consult with planning departments around the world or with the United Nations, I always ask, what is the problem you're trying to solve? Because the way we formulate that problem will dictate certain solutions. If the slum is your problem, you're going to try to clear it. But if the slum is a solution, what would you do? Sorry?
Find the problem.
In public health, I talk to my students about the causes behind the causes of disease. It is not enough to tell me that there is an animal vector that created Ebola. What is the cause behind that animal vector? It is not just a virus. There is a problem. Deforestation has been linked to the rise of Ebola in West Africa. You decrease the buffer between wildlife and human beings, you're going to increase vector-borne disease. It's just normal. Deforestation, historic deforestation. Guess what? In Kenya, deforestation created a problem where people who lived in the communities of the forest went to Nairobi because they had nowhere else to go. The solution in the international community is conservation. But guess what that does? It separates people from the natural environment. Franklin D. Roosevelt did that here in order to protect the environment. We're doing that now around the world, but it's harming the environment. Indigenous communities around the world are asking, are letting government and policymakers know, not all people are the same. Not all people want to extract. Some of us want to protect and heal Mother Earth. So this convergence, this interdependence, the recognition of human-nature interaction is increasingly changing the way the planet is looked at and the way the people and the planet are converging. Is that interesting? So we challenged policymakers in the slum. Not only did we ask them, how do you view the slum? What is the slum to you? What is the problem you're trying to solve? Have you spoken to community residents? They were like, yeah, we did. We did a survey with them. Oh, that's not really speaking to them. That's also an extractive industry. You're just going into the community and extracting information. The government says, well, we did this sanitation survey. Very interesting, the results of the sanitation survey. 80% of slum dwellers have access to sanitation. Eh. Have you been to the slum? I didn't see 80% of slum dwellers have access. Did you see 80% of slums 8 years ago have access to the slum, sanitation?
No, it was pretty
pretty filthy. And the government said, no, our statistics are valid. And I said, yes, but are they socially valid? Have you spoken to people? Yeah, we did a survey. Okay, but we're going to go and talk to people about how they conceptualize sanitation. Maybe that'll shed some light. So we were in the community. And I asked people, do you have access to sanitation? Yes. What is sanitation to you? Plastic bag. Interesting. And where do you dispose of your plastic bag? Next to the government wall over there. To let them know we need sanitation. Why is this important? Why is it important to address concepts in a fundamentally challenging way. It's important because policymakers will make policy based on that. So if you think the slum is a problem, you will make policies to eradicate the slum. If your surveys show that you have enough sanitation in the slum, you will no longer fund sanitation in the slum. We have to be constantly engaged in the discourses of society and challenge our assumptions about things that we deal with every day, whether that is the concept of citizenship, global citizenship, transformation, climate change, whatever you're passionate about. Do not assume that everyone thinks the same way you do. Let's take another example. I told you about Ebola. Let's take cardiovascular disease. Evidence shows that today more people will die of cardiovascular disease than Ebola. But where are all of the health resources currently going? Ebola preparation. How many of you are afraid of In-N-Out Burger? You should be more afraid of burgers than you are of Ebola. We got that under control in the U.S. We're not going to get sick. Unless you go and hug someone who is sweating and vomiting, who has Ebola, you are not going to get sick. It is not an airborne virus. But you eat a lot of burgers and kebabs. Same thing. Well, maybe not chicken kebab. I kind of love those. But we should be more afraid, and yet we're not. Why? What is it that we're not challenging? Engaging in that constant conversation, elevating our discourses to understand and conceptualize these fundamental concepts is critical, whether it's about health or sanitation or security. Our thoughts are our reality. If you continue on this health track, there was a very interesting study done by the African Population Health Research Council that's based in Nairobi, where health indicators were demonstrating that rural populations had had more mortality rates, higher mortality rates, than urban populations. So people in the villages were dying faster, according to this data, than people that lived in cities. And the government concluded, or the researchers concluded, well, this is because there's more access in the city to health services. Then when we went in and did some digging, and APHRC, the African Population Health Research Council, they started disaggregating or separating the data that they found in the urban setting, and they found that slum populations have such low health indicators, they were in shock. And they said, this is so fascinating. We thought that being close to a hospital meant increased health. No, no. As I teach my public health students, the moment you need a doctor, you've not succeeded in your job. Public health is about the prevention of disease and injury, not about treatment. The moment you get to discussion of health in treatment and doctors and health insurance, you're entering the realm of disease. That's not health discussion. The reason why this is so important in urban planning, it's because depending on where you are sitting in the planning profession, you have a different frame of health. I asked 76 planners in the state of California, what is health to you? And the reason why I did this is because healthy and sustainable communities has become the new buzzword in urban planning. Everybody wants to have a healthy and sustainable community. But what does that mean? And why are particular cities moving in one direction and other cities moving in another direction? So I started to do some exploration of this. I realized that planners in California have four interpretations of health that they use in planning practice. The first one is health as physical survival. So if you're not dead, you're healthy. Excellent. And guess what those planners and city councils put resources towards? Hospitals, doctors, clinics, emergency centers, and police presence. Then there are communities that look at health as physical well-being. They say if you have a certain weight, a certain BMI, then you're healthy. How do we get there? Increase your activity and increase access to healthy food. So all of the money goes to building farmers markets, walkability, bikeability, yoga in the park. All of the funding and resources go towards that. Then there are these very few communities in the state of California, for example, Santa Ana, South Los Angeles, Long Beach, who are saying, no, no, health is about social justice and empowerment. If our community is not empowered, if we cannot influence policy-making decisions, we are not a healthy community. And it doesn't matter that I'm healthy if my neighbor is not healthy. Equity is the essence of social well-being and justice. Then there's these amazing group of people, these planners that I have been in touch with and I'm maintaining contact with because it's the area of my new research. I don't know what else to call them, but socially conscious planners. They understand the interdependence of the land and people. They understand that a healthy planet means healthy people and healthy communities, and vice versa. They understand that a health solution is a climate solution. Getting out of your cars and walking, good for health, good for environment. Do you know that most of the trips in California in a car are within 1 mile? Really? Really? Do you know what could happen to your life if you walked that mile? You would be happier. You would be healthier. You could increase your life by about 5-6 years. You would decrease greenhouse gas emissions. Climate solutions are health solutions. These socially conscious planners are incredible. Most of them are in Northern California. Most of them. But there are some down here that I'm continuing to work with and learn from. And they're not just sitting in the planning offices. They're also activists. They're community residents. They're children. Let me tell you about one of the children. In one of the processes that I was observing for my dissertation in Long Beach, the donor had assigned me as the facilitator. So I was a participant observer, but I very much had an insider perspective. So I was, can you imagine being a researcher and a facilitator? It was a little bit hard to do, but it was so fascinating. It was a one-year project. And the community in Long Beach that I was working with was stuck on trying to figure out what does a governance structure look like for building a healthy community. We want to make these citizen teams and community organized like decision-making groups so that we can make decisions on funding when the donor gives it to us to know where we're going to put the money. Maybe a community garden, we don't know. So we wanted to create these like decision-making bodies. For about 4 months, they were stuck on what this 8-year-old girl, Victoria, called racial math. This girl was the child of one of the people in the community that was a leader. And she was always there. When I was doing the facilitation, she was like, Mo, can I like draw on this flip chart? It's kind of boring. I'm like, sure, draw. I didn't know she was paying attention. I had no idea. For 3 months, this young girl was paying attention to the conversation, which centered on, should we have odd number or even number on this team, on this decision-making body? Well, if we have even, then there'll be a tie and that would be hard. Let's have odd. Okay, but how are you going to divide up the racial ethnicity groups? Are we going to have 3 Asians, maybe 3 Latinas and or Latinos and 3 African-Americans? Well, not all Asians are the same. Are we going to have the same number of Korean-Americans, Cambodian? This was the conversation for 3 months. Kill me now. And I was told by the donors that I was not allowed to interject any advice. So I was going crazy and wanted to tear my hair out. Then one day, Victoria stands up. She was very sassy, so she stood up like this. Mo, and I said, yes, I love sassy chick, little girls. I was like, what's the matter? And she was like, can I say something? And I was like, yeah, of course. And I thought she was just going to say something about the flip chart. And she goes, I think you all need to just stop talking about this because I'm tired of hearing it. 8 years old. And she's like, stop it with the racial math. You should just pick people like me to serve on this committee. My mother is Latina. My father is African American. One of my grandmothers is white, and the other one is Native American. So if you pick people like me, then you don't have to do racial math. And you can focus, get this, you can focus on picking people that are not mean, that can understand that everybody has problems. All the adults just sat silent for about 15 minutes. They could not speak. And she was like, but whatever, I know you're just going to keep fighting about racial math. And she went on to make flowers on my flip charts. Did not understand that at 8 years old, she fundamentally transformed that discussion into understanding that decision makers should not be about race and the color of your skin. The adults started talking about the qualities they seek in their leaders. Whoa. We want someone who's trustworthy. We want someone that understands equity and justice for all people, not just what they look like, not just their gender, not just their race. I was dumbfounded. 8-year-old kid. The adults couldn't do it. From the mouth of babes. My studies in India and Kenya, and I'll talk to you about India in a minute, have shown me that we need to go beyond the discussions that perpetuate these old models. We have to go beyond that. You have heard the current crisis in our criminal justice system. You've heard it. But what are you hearing around it? How to improve the current system? How to resist the current system? How to reform the current system? I challenge you to create a new system. One that is founded on the principles of compassion, justice, wisdom, integrity, trustworthiness. Or as Victoria said, don't pick the mean people to do it. Yes, it's important to resist and reform, but it's just as important to build a process in parallel as one is destroying itself. Let it destroy itself. Let us build a better system. I promised to tell you about India. I recently was in India, and I had the wonderful opportunity of going out to the eastern part of the country where the Adivasi, the indigenous people, are mostly situated in the Niamgiri Hills. These indigenous communities have recently been plagued by government policies of economic growth, monoculture. One of the community leaders once said to me, the greatest sacrifice in our time is the sacrifice of agriculture for agribusiness. He invited me when I was in India. We're part of the Empowering Sustainability Fellows, the 25 of us from around the world who get together to discuss these things. He invited me to Orissa when I was in New Delhi. It took me 2.5-hour flight and an 18-hour train ride to get out there, and then like a 2-hour car ride. Very remote part of the country, lots of different industrialized farms, lots of deforestation. The indigenous people are losing their lands right, left, and center. And I went there to talk to some of these indigenous communities. And you know what one of the first questions I had from them? When was the last time your mother breastfed you? Mom, don't worry, I'm not going to tell them. And I said, I'm sorry? And I was laughing because I thought it was a joke. And they were like, no, not your biological mother, Mother Earth. And I was like, what do you mean? And they said, do you know what healthy soil is? Do you know how to take care of your mother? Have you ever thanked your mother for feeding you? I was dumbfounded. What was I going to say? They took me to an area that was, they called it monetized. It was a GMO crop of eucalyptus trees that they had put into a formerly extremely biodiverse, beautiful forest, which they grazed, which they got rid of. And they put this eucalyptus farm so that they could sell the wood to the cities for economic growth. And they were like, go touch that soil. I know nothing about soil, by the way, nothing. And I went and touched it, and it was rough. It was like cut up cardboard. Have you ever, you know, that feeling of dry, rough? It smelled funny. I was like, what? Oh. And they were like, now come over here. They took me to their forest. They're like, touch that soil. It was rich. It was life. It smelled like life. And they were like, if the government let us, we would heal our mother there. But it would take generations. They don't let us. You call that development? There was a grandmother in the community that pointed to a field full of plastic waste. She said, is this development to me? She can't read and write. She knows how to take care of her forest. And she says, why is it that when you people come here and have a conference to teach us how to do development, that's what you leave behind? Do you know not once has anyone listened to us about how to heal our mother? Why are we perpetuating these systems that are extremely maladaptive to the current exigencies and needs of our interdependent world? My dissertation research showed me that social transformation tends to occur when these different interpretations interact. The fancy way to say it in my dissertation is multi-frame interaction. But basically, it's about clash of opinions. When there is that clash of opinions, there is a spark of truth. When there is an opportunity for urban dwellers and indigenous people and policymakers to come together and have those clashes, an opportunity to change begins, is ignited. This has happened with the concept of sustainability throughout the last maybe 12, 15 years. What is the definition of sustainability that we use all the time? Anybody know? Who's heard of the Brundtland Commission? In like 1987, there was a commission formed by the United Nations that defined sustainability as basically the protection of resources today for the consumption of our future generation. There is so much argument and fight over this now. People do not like this. They're saying sustainability is not just about consumption. It's not just about the redistribution of resources between present and future. It is about reorganizing the way we interact with Mother Earth, with the land, with the water, with the people. It has generated such interesting progress around the world. In the legal field, in international law, we are talking about ecocide. You know what homicide is? International lawyers are talking about ecocide. And who would be on trial? The corporations. They're talking about aquacide. Indigenous communities are saying water is life. Corporations are dumping so much chemical waste in the water that they are creating a condition where water has become death. We need to bring them to account. We cannot sacrifice our planet for power. This interdependent world is shifting our conceptions of power right, left, and center. If I said to you, give me a synonym for power, yell something out.
Money.
Money. What else? Synonym for power.
Authority.
Authority. Control. What else?
Guns.
What else? Why are we thinking of power in such tangible context? I challenge my urban planning students and engineers who always believe that part of our job is to have power over the environment, control of the managing the environment. I challenge them to design differently by thinking of power with the environment. I say if you have to be coercive, maybe power doesn't really exist. There are scholars, most of them feminist scholars, critical organizational theorists, who say that there is no word that is used more carelessly than the word power. The moment you are coercing or controlling, you've lost power. Power exists, as Hannah Arendt said, only in concert, in unity. The capacity for collective stewardship is power. The capacity to understand compassion, to trigger the latent capacities in our human and organizational reality, those latent capacities of wisdom and justice and love. We had that beautiful quote about love is the secret of this divine dispensation. To be able to cultivate those capacities, we have to reorient our imagination and understanding of the concept of power. Money itself is a social construct. It's only because we all agreed that money has a certain type of value, that it has value, but it's just a piece of paper. Should money trump human security and health? That's what we're doing. Imagine if in the schools we cultivated the capacity for compassion and wisdom just as much as we cultivate the capacity for competition. Imagine how different our students would be. Imagine what global citizenship would look like if we thought outside of the realm of competition for scarce resources or power. If instead we said the only power is a collective, unified effort to protect the people, the planet, and everything in between. By the way, there are some examples in this in engineering. Who's heard of biomimicry? Isn't it biomimicry the coolest thing you ever heard? So there is a building, I'm just going to give you an example to explain biomimicry. There is a building in Seattle called the Bullet Center, which the engineers and the architects designed to act like a tree, mimicking nature. It takes in carbon dioxide and sends out oxygen. It's almost 100% climate neutral. It's awesome. This concept shift because engineers and architects have shifted the way they think about power. Let's do power with, not power over. Going back to the culture of planning, if we take Dr. Porter's thesis that the dominant culture of planning is embedded in colonial structures, then it makes sense that power has been misinterpreted and narrowly defined as control and authority, which, by the way, are the market system principles. There is a Harvard scholar that asked the question, what are we sacrificing if market principles, if the relationships we have between the buying and selling of goods and services are translated to a society and principles that govern society? Do we want all human relationships to be governed by the principle of the market? Really? Do you want your marriage to be defined as a transaction? Do you want love to be limited to 100% and you give 50 today and I give 50 today and maybe 7? What? Love is an unlimited resource. Let it shine through you. If love is the secret of this dispensation, as Gary read, why are we limiting it? Why are we using a market principle of control, competition in all human relationships? The essence of governance is to transform the relationships that we have with each other, with institutions, and with the land. When we cultivate the capacity to think differently, to challenge the borders in our mind, we are cultivating the capacity to work from love instead of fear. I got my little card, so I'm going to end with a conclusion that one of my students, I thought this was like a lecture for 3 hours. I apologize. A student of mine recently asked this question. We had a great debate in class. She asked me whether the emotion of anger was enough to sustain a social movement. Fabulous question. We had a great discussion in my class about the sustainability of anger as a motivator. And all of us came to the conclusion that it's not a very good motivator because it dies out. And then I read this story about Mandela, which I will conclude with and go to some questions. Cornel West speaks of the need for hope, creativity, and joy to help us rise out of oppression and the possibility of facing deep inner pain without bitterness or revenge. There is a story that he recounts of Mandela. Mandela had invited Botha, the previous president who had jailed him, to share the stage at an Independence Day celebration. Years later, Bill Clinton asked him, "Tell me the truth. Weren't you angry all over again?" Mandela responded, "I was angry. And I was a little afraid. After all, I'd not been free for that long. But when I felt that anger well up inside of me, I realized that if I hated them outside of jail, then they would still have me. I wanted to be free, so I let it go." Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Was that all over the place? Are you ready for a quiz? Mom, I hope you enjoyed it. Does anybody have any questions? Yes, please. Oh, Gary, first one. Go ahead.
Thank you. Do you feel, and thank you very much for your talk. My pleasure. Were wonderful. And do you feel that by developing global citizens out of our youth, we'll be more on the road to solving many of our world's problems?
Thank you for the question. I want to first challenge you to say that the youth of the world today are global citizens. In fact, we are all global citizens. But what we're doing is understanding deeper what that means. Citizenship tends to come with legal rights. You know, we think of citizenship in terms of a legal framework, a human rights framework. But I want to argue that it's about your approach and your relationships. When I went to India, the only thing that separated me from the community and the Adivasi community was I didn't speak their language. But you know what? If love is the secret, let me tell you, that is the secret of communication. When I sat with the people in the village, they spoke their language, I spoke English, sometimes Persian, just for fun. We understood each other. Because you know what we were saying? The same thing. I know you. You know me. We are global citizens. So, definitely global citizenship is an important paradigm to foster in our youth and adults, not just youth. But I would argue because we're already there, we are global citizens, we need to challenge the borders in our mind about what that means. How do we increase interdependence? How do we create systems that continue to build relationships, healthy and sustainable communities, change the relationships we have with each other, with the land, with institutions? Global citizenship is not just a buzzword. It is really understanding the soul-to-soul connection that we all share. Not just between people, but with our Mother Earth as well. You know, the indigenous community in Colombia believes that the oil in the earth is the blood of Mother Earth. And they were asking policymakers, what will you do if you bleed our mother dry? Can't you do something different to give us energy? Don't bleed her dry. She needs her blood. How do we incorporate this alternative framework in the understanding of global citizenship? That would be my answer. No other questions? I confused you that much? Oh, yes, please. Oh, wait, the microphone has to come. Sorry. Here first and then.
Thank you so much for the wonderful speak. And I learned a lot. And I was wondering if there is any, I'm pretty sure there is a lot, but I wanted someone like you. Is there any website or if I go online, can I find something to be really full of information you gave us?
There are so many organizations that are part of this social transformation, definitely. There's one called the Pachamama Alliance. There is Healthcare Without Harm. There is Engineers Without Borders. There is Urban Planners Without Borders. There is, oh my gosh, there's so many organizations. There's an organization called IPEN that works specifically for a pesticide-free world. There is an organization called Gaia, Incinerator Alternatives, that focuses on zero waste. There are indigenous communities around the world that are working on these issues. Oh my gosh, Global Science Monitor, that is a community-based monitoring organization that trains communities to go out there in the world and basically bring corporations and governments to account for policies that are not in line with sustainable and healthy communities. There are so many organizations. Within the state of California, the California Endowment has been doing incredible work on building healthy communities. First 5 LA has been doing incredible work to increase the healthy contexts in an equitable way for children under 5 throughout the state in 14 different communities. So many organizations. I could go on for like 10 hours talking to you about these organizations. Also, the United Nations just this year switched up their goals, their international goals for poverty eradication. They used to be called Millennium Development Goals. Now they're called Sustainable Development Goals. So we're constantly changing these frames of understanding. And if you want to follow up with me, I can send you articles and papers and things too.
Interested if I can see kind of a volunteer job.
About what? Say that again.
Volunteer job.
Oh, volunteer. Oh, my gosh. Any of the organizations I mentioned have volunteer opportunities. And as you know, in the Baha'i community, one of the most important service projects that the youth are engaged in, actually social action, is the junior youth groups. So many of these wonderfully empowered junior youth are challenging the way that the media presents society and reality. So they are having these discussions about positive and negative forces in society. And many of the junior youth groups around the world are focusing on this concern for the environment. It's fascinating that that's kind of become a unifying factor for all these amazing junior youth groups. Even in Anaheim, I accompany some of the animators in Anaheim, and we're just blown away by these junior youth who want to have these conversations. The junior youth capacity for recognizing hypocrisy is amazing. It's amazing. And they'll just call you out on it. Kind of like Victoria, my little sassy 8-year-old. They call you out on it. But depending on what city you live in, you can also go to your local city council. There's always a planning commission. And they always need residents to help them build healthy communities. So I would say you can even go into that area too. But definitely the junior youth groups, get involved with them.
Thank you very much.
So here, and then in the front, and then there was one more here. Jamshi, do we still have time? Two more questions? Okay, can I do three? Okay, three. I'm doing three. Okay, please.
Good negotiations. I work at California State University in Long Beach.
Oh, wonderful.
I'm really curious about the project and who you were working with, but maybe I can follow up later on that. My question centers on, so I'm an old Baha'i from the 60s when we were all very hopeful about social transformation outside of our own Baha'i communities. Do you sense some kind of tipping point or window of opportunity now that maybe hasn't been around for a while? Can you speak to that idea?
It's a great question. I get that question a lot, actually. Honestly, the tipping point started back in 1863. But because of media and social, these kind of social, what are they called? Social media, is that what it's called? Sorry. These social media outlets, the communication across youth in the world is amazing. The majority of the world's population is under 25. That to me is hope. The young people today refuse to stand up for impunity of a whole bunch of stuff. They're like, well, no, there is no violence against women. No. I don't know if you remember, there were some horrible rape cases in India in the last couple of years where young boys in school were raising up and showing these placards that said, don't teach your girls not to go out, teach your boys to respect women and the equality of women. These were like 9, 10-year-old boys. Definitely there is a tipping point because there is very few people in the world that would argue with the principles of this day and age. Equality of men and women, it's a reality. And people that have a hard time with that are being ostracized. And guess what? Men are realizing that the equality of men and women is not just good for women, it's good for men. How many times have you heard men shouldn't cry? Well, guess what? Equality of men and women, go ahead and cry, honey. No problem. The soul has no gender. It has no race. It has no class. It has no status. The soul doesn't care if you carry a designer bag. Doesn't care. Definitely there is a tipping point because we are recognizing the dignity of the human soul and the connections that we have, and it is like wildfire. It doesn't matter what country I go to, a village or a city, everyone is talking about the same thing. It's amazing. And I want to reiterate something I heard Layli Miller Moreau say, the director of the Tahrir Justice Center. The Baha'is do not have a monopoly on the principles. Everybody believes in the equality of men and women. Everyone believes in universal education. Right? Everyone believes the importance of a universal language. We're just not sure which one it is yet. People are starting to understand the agreement between science and religion. You cannot have science without a system of values. And you can't have religion be so superstitious that it's not recognizing science. It's funny to talk about them in this day and age because everybody gets it and understands it. And it's like, well, of course. You know? So definitely there's a tipping point. Definitely, definitely. Sorry that I went too far. Can we do two more questions? Okay, sorry. Yeah.
I actually just have two quick statements. One is that the sustainable development goals that you mentioned through the United Nations, they're actually still being developed and won't really be implemented until after 2015. Right. So there's a chance for everybody to have a say in what those goals are. There's a website, vote.myworld2015.org, and that's where the United Nations is gathering input. So you can all go there and provide your input. And I also wanted to mention, you brought up the word stewardship several times and dominance. And I find it interesting that there are different translations from the book of Genesis. One translation says that humans were given stewardship over the earth, and another translation says that humans were given dominion over the earth. So just that difference in translation has really had an effect on the culture and the mindset that Western civilization has developed.
Thank you. There was one other question, I think, here. Or statement.
Thank you so much for your talk. One of the concepts that I discerned from your comments, I would describe as an appreciation of dialectics, the idea that opposites sometimes have an underlying commonality and that the challenge is to discern that commonality. One of the examples you used was religion and science. Another one that's locally important to us is that our urban planners are feeling very misunderstood these days. There was a kind of a revolution of residents, which went under the name of residocracy here in Santa Monica. The residents felt manipulated by the urban planners. The urban planners feel misunderstood. So to me, that is a certain kind of dialectic where you have the people who are employed to serve the community feeling as if the community has not understood them, and the community members who should be being served feel they're being manipulated. I wonder if, as an urban planner, you have ever consulted with other urban planners to address those kinds of issues in the field, in practice.
We have. That's an excellent question, and something I hear a lot from in urban planning, actually. Urban planners are often saying that, and communities are often disgruntled, and they feel that way as well. And one of the challenges is because community participation is ingrained with a specific model in urban planning. They have to have public meetings. And communities don't like that. They're like, no, let's just have a space to talk. And some things that have been done differently, for example, in Westminster, there's a city manager. A few years ago, he needed some input from Little Saigon, from business leaders in Little Saigon. He kept having these public meetings. No one would show up. Then he hired a Vietnamese-American intern who was like, well, obviously they're not going to show up, you dingbat. They're not going to show up because they come from a context where all authority is to be shunned. You need to go into the community. Why aren't the planners going and talking to people? Why are you just sitting and doing GIS mapping? Go and talk. And the city manager was like, that's an amazing... And the girl was like, really, that's amazing to you? That's like part of the planning practice that we learn. So he was like, okay, you do it. So she and her colleagues, like the staff, went out and talked to the business owners in Little Saigon. And basically they were asking them, how would you redesign the community if you could? So they could put inputs into the general plan updates, which are mandated in the state of California. They had such fruitful comments that they went back, they wrote a report. The city manager was so excited. He implemented all this stuff, and they got this award from the American Planning Association for being innovative. And this young girl, who was a master's student actually at UCI, said to me, you know, for us it was so normal. We have to re-engage with the community. Planners have kind of disengaged and become this institution. But really, we're advocates for the community. And so one of the ways that we can bridge this gap is increasing dialogue, perhaps in intimate settings, and not having the policymakers there yet. Because sometimes when their bosses are in the room, when the city council members are in the room, or the planning commission is in the room, the planners feel shy. But when the planners are able to go out into the community and get some input, when they do walkabouts and run around, that's how we bridge that gap, to transform the way we think about community engagement. Thank you so much. I know you're all excited to hear more music. It's my pleasure.
Friends, I need to borrow a statement from her. That wasn't really right. We need to do it again. We really need to appreciate the wonderful job she did. Let's do it. Thank you.